This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. What do you do when a dream dies? Our first story is about a man who faced that situation and then ended up in the NFL. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has more.
Joe Cardona worked two full-time jobs last year. This was one of them.
Allen to hold it, Gostkowski to kick it, Joe Cardona to snap it, and the kick is good.
Cardona was a rookie long snapper for the NFL's New England Patriots. His second job involved a bunch of 18 and 19-year-olds.
A large part of it was, you know, ensuring that they're studying, just ensuring good general order and discipline in the hallways.
Cardona worked at the Naval Academy Preparatory School, located 60 miles from Gillette Stadium in Newport, Rhode Island. Because Joe Cardona, long snapper for the New England Patriots, is also an ensign in the U.S. Navy. The only active member of the military in the NFL in 2015, Cardona started every game for the Patriots. So how did an active duty Navy ensign end up in the NFL? Or, put another way, how did an active NFL player end up in the Navy? Let's start here. Cardona can't remember the first time he saw the movie Top Gun.
I must have been young. My dad always came up with the line whenever I'd ask for something. He'd say, "That's a negative, Ghost Rider. The pattern's full."
Joe Cardona's dad spent 24 years in the Navy. He still works on naval bases in San Diego, where Joe grew up.
Being in San Diego, you have Marine Corps Air Station Miramar. You know, you have jets flying around everywhere. My dad would always point them out to me. Those F-18, whatnot, something like that.
Those jets flying overhead, plus that movie about hotshot naval aviators.
I feel the need for speed.
Gave young Joe Cardona an idea of what he wanted to be when he grew up.
You know, maybe be a pilot or something, you know, the Top Gun. You know, it could be Goose or Maverick.
And when he was in the eighth grade, Joe Cardona and his class took a trip to the East Coast. They stopped in Annapolis, Maryland, at the Naval Academy.
It's breathtaking, honestly. The campus itself, you see mids in uniform walking around. And as a young kid in eighth grade, I just saw myself wanting to be there.
By the time he and his classmates left, Cardona knew where he wanted to go to college. In the meantime, he brought home what would become his favorite Navy football t-shirts.
One of them said Anchors Away on the front. It was like a men's small, but I just continued to stretch it as I grew, and I cut the sleeves off and everything. I wore that around everywhere.
Cardona was about to start high school, and he wanted to play football, but
I was probably about 5'8", maybe about 140 going into high school.
Cardona's dad was worried his son wouldn't get to play, so he came up with a strategy.
He goes, "Well, you're too small to be a lineman, and you're too slow to do anything else. So we're going to make sure you're good at snapping so that at least you have a position on the field."
The long snapper's job is to hike the ball on punts and field goal attempts. It calls for precision and consistency, not speed and strength. Cardona bought in. He took snapping seriously.
It was just something that kind of came naturally.
Cardona got good enough and big enough, he's 6'2" now, to play other positions in high school. But he held on to the snapping. And you can probably guess what happened next. A certain college football program from Maryland was in the market for a long snapper. During junior year, one of Cardona's high school coaches pulled him aside. The coach asked if he could send Cardona's recruiting tape to the Naval Academy.
And instantly the light, you know, went off in my head. I immediately was like, "Yes, please send my stuff there. I'm very interested in it."
Even though the Academy's football program was interested in Cardona, he still had to go through the full application process. That meant writing essays, interviewing with his congressman, passing a conditioning test, and more. Eventually, a thick packet showed up at his house.
It was a huge moment for me, one I'll definitely never forget. It was just a dream come true, really. I wasn't jumping up and down. I think we're more stoic than that. But, definitely a great moment.
At that point, when you're committing to the Naval Academy, where's the NFL in your brain?
I wasn't even thinking about the NFL.
Cardona was still thinking about becoming a pilot. Once he got to Annapolis, he traded in those old Navy football t-shirts for a real jersey. He became just the second freshman in Navy history to start at long snapper. And it wasn't long before he was considered one of the best long snappers in the country. Still, Cardona wasn't dreaming of a career in football. Then came his junior year and something called pre-commissioning physicals.
They give you all these medical tests and stuff, and then part of it is the flight physical, which measures your basic measurements all around your body. And so my torso was too long. I could fly helicopters and some of the bigger aircraft, but I got disqualified from jets. And I basically asked the doctor, I go, hey, you know, what's the big deal? Like, it's just my sitting height, and it's only by a few, like, maybe a half an inch. And he's like, well, Joe, if you have to eject from your aircraft, not all of you is going to make it out. So I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to fly that, then I'll be fine. So that was actually a moment where I said, okay, well, if I can't fly jets, which is what I came here wanting to do, maybe I'll give the NFL a shot. And that was really my junior year.
A year and a half later, the Patriots decided to give Joe Cardona a shot. They picked him in the fifth round of the 2015 NFL draft, making him just the fourth long snapper ever selected. It was a bit of a risky move, because Cardona, as a Navy grad, had a five-year service commitment. That meant he could be stationed almost anywhere, and that he'd potentially have to put his football career on hold. But the Navy worked out a plan. Cardona was stationed in Newport, Rhode Island, with a schedule that allowed him to both serve and snap. During the week, he'd drive back and forth between Foxborough and Newport from practices to shifts at the Naval Academy Prep School. Of course, he worked most Sundays, too. His schedule didn't allow him to do much else, like rest.
Tuesday was the overnight. You can get some sleep here and there, but you're always, you know, on call to be woken up for whatever myriad of things. General tomfoolery will be had. People get sick throughout the night, stuff like that. It was, I mean, just general things.
Then he'd hop in his car and drive to Foxborough for practice Wednesday afternoon. On the way there, Cardona would try to switch gears.
I'm sure the Massachusetts State Police wouldn't appreciate me, you know, talking about me going over game plans on my way up. But, you know, just making sure I was ready for whatever practice would hold. Just checking over things as I was driving and, you know, going through mental reps in my head.
Then he was on the field in Foxborough for afternoon practice.
You know, it was all go here. There was no showing up and being, you know, lackadaisical or being tired. It was no excuses as far as that goes. I had to do my job.
And by all accounts, Cardona did his job. Actually, both of them. This year, Cardona's schedule is a bit easier. He's now a reservist, so he doesn't have to worry about working full-time at the academy. But he knows that his orders could change, and his NFL career could be interrupted.
You know, if they need me to deploy or anything like that, that's what they'll do, and that's what I'll do. You know, it's something that, you know, I accepted when I took the oath. I'm making the most of the opportunity that's in front of me right now, but there are things that are more important than football in this world, and if that were what was asked of me, I'd be, you know, excited and ready to do whatever's asked.
Joe Cardona was too slow to be a running back. He was too small to be a lineman, and he was too big to fly a jet. But to long snap for the New England Patriots while serving as a reservist in the U.S. Navy? Joe Cardona is just right. For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
Almost 70 years ago, Pee-wee Reese, who played shortstop for the then Brooklyn Dodgers, walked across the infield in Cincinnati and put his arm around the shoulder of his teammate, Jackie Robinson. Or so the story goes. You know the story if you saw the movie 42, a tribute to Robinson's courage and determination during the season when he broke the color line in Major League Baseball. The story's significance comes partly from the fact that Reese was a Southerner, born in Kentucky, and, at least according to the story, he was also taking heat from the Cincinnati fans for playing on the same team with a black man. Ken Burns, who's researched baseball history about as thoroughly as anybody, says he never found any evidence that the anecdote is true. Jonathan Eig, one of Robinson's biographers, agrees. Maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe the story of Reese putting his arm around Robinson's shoulder to demonstrate that he was on his teammate's side rather than on the side of the bigots who were shouting at Robinson and at Reese was so necessary that somebody had to invent it. That would put the story in lots of good company. But on Wednesday night, we got a story of unity that did happen. You can find photographic evidence of it. The setting was Indianapolis rather than Cincinnati. The game was basketball rather than baseball. And the players were women rather than men, which is why you might not have heard the story. On Wednesday night, before the game that would determine whether the Indiana Fever or the Phoenix Mercury advanced in the WNBA's postseason, all the members of the Fever took a knee before the playing of the national anthem. All of them. Most of the members of the Indiana Fever are black, but several players are white, and they were kneeling too. And their coach, Stephanie White, is also white, and this is what she had to say about what the players on her team had decided to do as one. I'm proud of you all for doing that together, being in that together. That's big. It's bigger than basketball, right? Bigger than basketball. In 1947, racism was a problem for Jackie Robinson, who had to battle it and did, and died younger than he otherwise might have done. It was also a challenge for Pee Wee Reese, who, to his credit and thanks to his association with Robinson, learned that much of what he'd absorbed and assumed during his formative years was rubbish. In 2016, the violent behavior of some police officers toward black men is obviously a critical problem for the victims of that violence and for their families and for their communities. But it's also a problem for anyone who believes that equal rights under the law and the administration of justice without regard to race or any other distinction are necessary to a legitimate democracy. It represents a challenge for anyone who wants this country to be better. On Wednesday night, a team of players, black and white, embodied that concern. A whole team, and nobody had to make it up. It happened. There's lots more to come on Only a Game, but while you're thinking about it, consider leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners find our podcast, and we always like to hear your thoughts on our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's been a month since the closing ceremonies in Rio, but the Olympics are still in the news, and that's because another city has said no to the opportunity to host the 2024 Games. And that's where we will start this week's three stories you should know. My guests this time around are Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports via Skype and Cindy Boren of The Washington Post. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Always great to be here.
Patrick, tell me about this city that has said, as I understand it, no grazie to the IOC.
So this week, the mayor of Rome, Virginia Raggi, she publicly rejected the city's bid for the 2024 Summer Games and said it would be irresponsible for Rome to bid on the event, given the long history of massive government overspending on the Olympics and her own struggles to repair and restore some of the basic civil services in Rome. To this, I can only say one thing. Bravo. Cities and countries throw away billions of dollars essentially to put on a three-week reality TV show. And they commit all sorts of icky human rights violations in the process. So you really double up there. And on the back end, you get nothing to show for it except a bunch of rotting, useless sports stadiums, you know, the occasional boondoggle public transportation project, and a big pile of public debt. A lot of cities like Rome are starting to wake up to this. The bad news is that this isn't actually pressuring the International Olympic Committee to, you know, lessen the demands they place on host cities, or maybe even, God forbid, pay for some of this themselves. Instead, you see the Olympics going to image-conscious, authoritarian regimes, places like Russia and China.
All right, Patrick, I just want to say that some of those human rights violations were a good deal more serious than icky.
Yeah, I was trying to imagine human rights violations that weren't actually icky, and I couldn't come up with one.
I don't blame you.
God, the two editors here
today. I know, we're just killing you, aren't we? But in all seriousness, the bottom line with the Olympics is it's a TV event. And like a set right behind the facade, there's a lot of, to use your word, icky stuff going on. You saw that in Rio all the time. You didn't see it on TV very often. But our reporters, as they were walking to the different venues, were walking past open sewers, giant, running, gross, disgusting open sewers. Really had to kind of cover their faces to be able to breathe. You know, at some point, you just have to say, where are people's priorities here?
I think I feel compelled to say on behalf of the TV show, it is a great spectacle. And at its best, the Olympics does, in fact, give us something, many things, to cheer about. But I agree with you. And I wonder if what you're talking about is perhaps moving us closer to the time when we're going to get a permanent site?
I'm stunned to find out that you're a cockeyed optimist, though.
Cindy, you're keeping tabs on NFL uniform rules, and as I understand, that means reading at least 9 pages in the NFL rulebook. But bring us up to date on the NFL uniform rules, please.
Well, you'll recall that the opening of the NFL season, the opening Sunday, happened to coincide with the 15th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks. And several players, about a half dozen, chose to wear shoes that were garishly patriotic. I mean, they were really bright and they were really cool, and it was really a good instinct that they had to wear those. And, of course, the NFL does not like that because they want their uniforms to be uniform. And the NFL has generously said it will not fine these players for wearing their patriotic shoes. The NFL is considering whether to allow players on one week, you know, week 13, when probably half of the teams are kind of playing out the string. They may allow players to wear freely whatever they wish, as long as they have prior approval. The NFL is trying to get its arms around this optically, but they also want to control it because it's the NFL. And, you know, you don't want to go too far. You may not have noticed this, but they're incredibly conservative.
First of all, look, we should always remember this is the same NFL that until recently was charging the military for patriotic displays. The NFL is it's pretty authoritarian. Let's not mince words about it. And I think in some ways that's also what fans of the NFL like. They sort of like the idea of players being put into their place, you know, so the quote-unquote the infantry man following orders. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of football culture. That's the culture. That's the fantasy. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why fans get so bent out of shape when players stand out.
Well, it strikes me as curious that the players have to be acting as soldiers, everybody doing their part and working together as a unit, and yet they can't put on patriotic shoes, which you would think would
exactly
be something soldiers might do from time
and
to time.
I think someone at the NFL said, let's just back off here. You know, it would have looked ugly. It really would have.
And you know what? You might see more of that in the future if the NFL can figure out a way to make money off of it.
My story this week is also set in the NFL. According to 1,100 citizens who were recently polled by ePoll Marketing Research, Colin Kaepernick is the most disliked player in the NFL. Now, for the record, Kaepernick's offense was electing to sit or kneel rather than stand while they were playing the national anthem. Kaepernick is more disliked than Ben Roethlisberger, who was suspended several years ago after accusations that he had sexually assaulted a woman in a Georgia nightclub. Kaepernick is more disliked than Jameis Winston, allegedly a rapist, demonstrably a thief, and a guy dumb enough to shoot at squirrels with a pellet gun in a residential area and shout expletives in a cafeteria full of students. Maybe the 1,100 citizens who were polled are unrepresentative. Maybe they don't remember anything that hasn't happened within the past couple of weeks. And if so, perhaps I shouldn't worry. But I do. Cindy, should I?
I don't know what to make of that survey, frankly. His jersey initially was being burned by fans, 49ers fans, and then the sales skyrocketed there for a couple of weeks. It was the top-selling jersey in the NFL. So my take on the poll is it just shows how polarized everyone is about everything. You know, Kaepernick can still have one of the top-selling jerseys, and then you can poll people and people hate him. We're in a weird, weird time right now.
I would love to see a Venn diagram of sort of Donald Trump supporters and the people who answered, you know, Colin Kaepernick's my least favorite player. I'm not even sure it would be a diagram. I think it might just be one circle. And there was another poll this week that I think shows us a little bit. It was a Yahoo YouGov poll, and it said 44% of about 1,000 fans who were surveyed said they would stop watching NFL games if protests like Kaepernick's continue. Now, we had a little piece on this at Vice Sports, and the headline read, Yahoo survey shows 44% of fans would stop watching NFL games, comma, and are liars, which basically sums up how I see this. Over and over and over, there are all these sort of off-field controversies that give you plenty of good reasons to turn off the television if you really wanted to. People don't turn off the television. They like football.
Maybe there should be a rule against surveys. My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports and Cindy Boren of The Washington Post. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Our next story is about boxing, but even if you're not a fan of boxing, I want you to stick around because our next story is also about mothers and daughters And if you're not a fan of mothers and daughters, well, go ahead. Don't stick around. Here's WBC International Super Bantam and Featherweight Champion Heather Hardy in her own words.
When I was a little kid, I was the biggest Yankee fan on the planet. And I really used to dream of running out of the bullpen and pitching like the eighth and the ninth innings and closing out a World Series game. And they didn't let girls play Little League. And I remember feeling sorry, like, why do I have to like baseball if I can't do anything? Why do I have to be a girl? After I had my daughter, like, for everything on paper, it looked like I should have been happy. You know, I had my daughter in preschool. I had a husband with a pension. I had health insurance. I mean, everything was so nice. But I felt like I was missing something in my life. Like, I would drop my daughter off to preschool and felt like, I can't believe I don't love this. And I felt like, am I a bad mother? Am I a bad woman? Am I bad at being a wife? Because I didn't love it. I didn't want to talk about coupons and go out for brunch with all the other moms. Like, I wanted to go back to this little karate school where I was taking classes and I could just be Heather. And I was taking these little kickboxing classes, or they put the radio on real loud and you jump around and hit the bag. And after 3 weeks of taking these classes, 3 weeks ever having gloves on my hands, the fight instructor asked me how much I weighed. So I told her, and she says, well, there is a kickboxing match in 2 or 3 weeks, and do you want to do it? And so much was missing in my life. Like I had this empty hole. I thought, why not? Why not? I'll do it. So here I am, the shyest girl in the world. Like, I'm the girl who will walk into a room and sit by myself. But for whatever reason, we're walking through that crowd of 2,000 people with the spotlights and the radio on and standing in that ring and beating this girl up so bad. I felt like a million puzzle pieces came together and just told me, this is what you're here for. This is your life. Very shortly after my first fight, went through a divorce, and it was like, leave. And he finally said, fine. And he took everything and he went. And I had Annie at home. I was working up to 6 jobs just to put food on the table for my daughter. My sister was living with me with her son, and she also wasn't getting child support. It was satisfying because I had mentally told myself that I was gonna make it, that I knew I could make it, that I had to get some more jobs, but I would do it, and we did. I mean, there were days I came home where we didn't even have 2 eggs to crack, and my sister would always joke about it and take my daughter with her little fake play shopping cart over to my mom's to go grocery shopping at grandma's house. When you have a kid and you have to do it, you figure it out. I just kind of evolved from the kickboxing. I had lost a fight. And the girl that I fought, she barely even kicked me. She just beat me with a jab and a right hand. So the next day I went back to the karate school and said, you know, I will train 2-a-days, 3-a-days all summer. I want to do the rematch. Teach me how to beat her. And the coach at the time told me, "Hun, I don't want to disappoint you, but you got to accept that this sport isn't for everybody. Some people got it and some people don't. And maybe you just ain't one of them that got it." I kind of went home thinking like, man, maybe she's right. I still had a fire, you know, the same fire that I said, something's missing, I have to find what it is. I took a lot of time off, but so much of me was missing, not boxing, kickboxing, fighting, that I said, I got to go to Gleason's. I got to find a coach and find out if it's true. Within a year, I was ranked number 1 in the country as a boxer, so I guess I did have it. After I won the 2012 Golden Gloves, I came to the gym. And I said, all right, I'm ready to go pro. I won everything I want to win as an amateur. And one of the guys from my gym, we call him Blimp, he's a big guy. Blimp's son was signed with DiBella. Lou DiBella is probably the biggest boxing promoter on the East Coast. So he said to me, I'm going to talk to him for you. So he came into the gym next day and said, listen, I could get you a fight on the card, but you got to promise me you're going to sell 10,000 in tickets. I guarantee them $10,000 in ticket sales. So I said, all right, I'll do it. And he looked at me like I was crazy. I said, no, I'm telling you, I'll do it. I don't care how I'll do it, but I will do it. My promoter was paying me $800. I sold $13,000 in tickets for my first fight. A lot of the girls told me just know going in that this is a hobby. This isn't a life. You do this because you love it, but you'll never make any money off it. I had that same feeling, like, why did I have to be good at this? When you have networks, big TV networks, who are saying that they're not ready to air female fights, it makes it hard for the promoters to put us and invest money in us because promoters make money when they get their fighters on TV. So for my whole career, I kind of just swallowed it, that I have two jobs. I have to win my boxing fights and I have to sell tickets and market myself. Then I fought in June on the Sean Porter and Keith Thurman undercard, which was going to be on NBC. And I had this big pitch. You know, Ronda Rousey made millions because Dana White put her on a pay-per-view card that millions of people were going to be purchasing and tuning into. The public had no chance but to either love her or hate her, and they loved her. And my thought in June was, tell me, what do you think would happen if Heather Hardy showed up and fought before Keith Thurman and Sean Porter? Would people turn off their television sets? And everyone kind of laughed about it, like, that's never going to happen. We're never going to do that. And I fought on the undercard, got another nice win. It was kind of like, oh, Heather's just never satisfied with what she gets. And then I kind of turned into that woman, the woman who was always asking for more. It was really discouraging because it seemed to me like everyone was missing the point. It's not about me. It's about all the other girls who are doing this, who deserve a chance. Like, what don't you guys get? I finally backed off, and I just kind of shut up and thought, you know, I'm always the one that's calling. Hey, I heard this one's fighting. Put me on the card. Oh, I heard this one's fighting. Put me on the card. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to make any more phone calls now. So I was kind of toying with the idea of switching to MMA. I was kickboxing again. And then I got a call from Lou DiBella himself. And it was about midnight, and I was drinking wine and eating pizza, and he says, I got something cooking. I said, is it going to be on TV? He said, I'm working on it. I threw that pizza down. It was back to running my miles.
Presenting Heather the Heat Hardy.
I was fighting Shelley Vincent. She's also an undefeated fighter from Rhode Island. We had a lot of people there. Pretty much packed the venue with people dying to see this fight. Other than to say I was super satisfied knowing that we were on television, didn't feel any different. That bell rings, punches in the face are still the same. One thing about this girl was she was so tough. She kept the fight through right to the end, and I won, and I beat her. And that was probably one of the most satisfying moments of my career. No freedom till we're equal, you know. My fight on August 21st was the first female fight televised on a PBC show, which is a long list of things that I've been the first female to do. Which is kind of sad in 2016 that I've had so many. Heather Hardy was the first female to fight at the Barclays, the first female to fight on the undercard of a PBC, the first female to fight on TV. You know, I want to be the first female to make some money doing this like the boys do. I'm not going to stop, not because I'm not satisfied, but because until the playing field is equal, you can't stop. I can't be satisfied with, okay, we gave her enough. Enough isn't enough for me. All of this has been so that my daughter, so that no one's daughter, has to feel like they're sorry that they're a girl. And if I could give anything to my own kid, it would be for her to see how hard her mom fought to make a future for her and to make it so that things are a little bit different the next go around.
That's boxer Heather Hardy. Our story was produced by Only a Game's Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Coming up on Only a Game, Tug Coker has starred on Broadway and on television, but he can't help thinking about his basketball days. I'm Bill Littlefield. Next week on Only a Game, ESPN's Tim Kirkjian on one of baseball's funniest and most painful unwritten rules. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill, and welcome back to the Only a Game family to our friends at Minnesota Public Radio.
With about a week to go in Major League Baseball's regular season, Adam Jones of the Baltimore Orioles has said that playing before the home crowd has been, quote, eerie. I don't know if they're ghosts at the ballpark or what. What's going on in Baltimore?
Nobody's going to the games.
Ah.
Remember when Camden Yards was the go-to place in all of baseball for its nostalgic and well-marketed charm? Nobody's
yes,
going
I
to
do.
See the Orioles play right now.
The charm has worn off, huh?
They're drawing 20,000 for a game against Boston in the middle of a pennant race.
Charlie, the Cincinnati Reds are not the worst team in baseball. The Twins have won fewer games than the Reds. However, one assessment I read this week suggested that the Reds' pitching staff was the worst of all time. Some analytic applications suggest this. Quite a distinction if it's true, don't you think?
Well, yeah. Cincinnati's pitchers allow an average of 1.6 home runs every 9 innings, or one every 21 at-bats. And I don't have, I mean, I did not have to take the Nate Silver course in advanced analytics to know that that's too many home runs
that's
to give up.
That's not good. Giants pitcher Madison Bumgarner started a bench-clearing brawl on Monday night by repeatedly screaming at Yasiel Puig of the Dodgers for looking at him. So the Dodgers showed up on Twitter in T-shirts reading, "Don't look at me." This doesn't happen in other sports, does it?
I'll tell you what, this is some expert trolling. This is some grade-A concierge-level trolling by the Dodgers. Very, very well done. I do like the guy, too, that's wearing the hat from the USS New Jersey.
On Thursday, Seattle Seahawks wide receiver Doug Baldwin made a plea for attorneys general of all 50 states to review, quote, training policies for police and law enforcement. This is following the latest police shootings of African Americans in Charlotte and Tulsa. Did any of those attorneys general respond?
Yes, the Attorney General of Washington, Bob Ferguson, answered on his Twitter account saying that he'd like to sit down with Baldwin, and I think that's all to the good, and I'm really happy to see athletes stepping up on this particular issue because they know they all have kids and they know what can happen if you look at somebody the wrong way or, excuse me, fail to comply.
In Tega Cay, South Carolina, the only football available for kids age 7 through 12 now is flag football. Tackle football has been on the decline for a few years. I guess maybe we're looking at a positive trend.
Yeah, this is a development that we're going to see in a lot of places. It's interesting that it's beginning in the South where, of course, football is very well established. But parents are going to start looking at and realize the game isn't worth the candle.
Former NBA guard and current Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson got hit in the face with a pie on Wednesday at a charity dinner, and I assume he took it all in good fun, as anybody getting hit in the face with a pie might do, right?
No, he beat the hell out of the guy, and while I don't approve of people who hit other people in the face with pies, Kevin Johnson has been a pretty awful mayor, and frankly, I think if anybody in public life these days deserved a pie, it was him. As Chris Rock says, I don't approve of hitting people in the face with pies, but I understand.
The NBA has told its referees that when the season starts, they need to be on the lookout for groin hits. So I guess we're going to see enforcement of the Draymond Green rule.
Draymond and his family must be completely proud that his name has been attached to a rule making it a point of emphasis not to kick your opponent in the nether regions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear what he's up to.
I don't know who is going to prevail in the World Cup of Hockey, Charlie, but I want
but
to focus.
But I know who won't.
I want to focus for a minute on a team that will not be participating in the final two rounds. Team USA, they didn't win a single game.
And they looked awful doing it, but at least they respected the national anthem, which is what John Tortorella, who likely will not be coaching this team again, made sure before things started that they would be respecting the national anthem and none of this Kaepernick stuff. Great. And then your team went out there and laid a giant egg.
And finally, Charlie, minor league baseball teams are not usually allowed to use a player's name or image until he makes it to the major leagues, but an exception has been made for Mets minor leaguer Tim Tebow, and the result is that last weekend, when the Tebow shirts first became available, that shirt topped sales for Major League Baseball's online shops. Not bad for a fellow who couldn't play quarterback and probably won't make the major league.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Tebow can't complete passes, but he can close sales, that's for sure. I think that every sport should just have a Tebow jersey now.
Ooh.
I think there should be an NHL Tebow jersey, maybe some golf equipment, Davis Cup tennis perhaps, next Olympic. I think the next Olympic team should have Tebow on the back of all their gear.
And you forgot soccer.
Soccer's sort of doing okay around the world without Tim Tebow, but, you know, you never can tell. I'd keep him in reserve.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Earlier in the show, we brought you a story about what happens when a dream dies, and now we'd like to bring you a story about what happens when a dream morphs into an entirely different dream, but still manages to accomplish the same goals as the original dream. And it's going to make sense, we promise. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
The first time I saw Tug Coker, he was standing on a Broadway stage wearing a blonde wig, a Celtics home uniform, the kind from the 80s with the short shorts, and what might just be the worst fake mustache I've ever seen. I didn't get to talk to Tug that day back in 2012 for reasons I'll get to in a bit, but I knew Tug wouldn't have been standing on that Broadway stage if he hadn't failed as a basketball player in college. So when we finally got the chance to speak, I asked him to start there. But Tug Coker had other plans.
Well, actually, I'm going to back up just a little
bit.
Sure. So I grew up in Virginia. Sports were my life. I just grew up playing sports all the time, loving sports. But at the same time, I just loved movies, and I loved theater, and I loved film. And, you know, The Wizard of Oz is my favorite movie of all time. I remember when I was 5 years old, and I would pause the VCR to write down the Scarecrow's lines because I loved the Scarecrow so much.
Are you doing that on purpose? Or can't you make up your mind?
That's the trouble. I can't make up my mind. I haven't got a brain.
I couldn't do plays because I was always doing a sport, whether I was playing tennis or basketball or soccer or something like that. I couldn't do the plays, but I did the classes.
Tug's favorite sport was basketball, but his high school playing days aren't all happy memories.
Honestly, most of my looking back is filled with some regret because I didn't maximize the opportunity. Princeton came to watch me play one night against a team that I thought we could crush in high school, and I scored 7 points, and that it embarrassed myself, and Princeton didn't give me another look.
Tug ended up at William & Mary, where he never got the chance to play.
You know, around the last week of practice, one of the coaches came up to me and said, Tug, I think you can really play. I think you can really play at this level. And I was so happy to hear that.
But not happy enough to stick around. Tug wanted to play at a bigger school, so he transferred to the University of Virginia, where the new coach told him thanks, but no thanks. So with basketball out of the picture, Tug turned to his other love, theater. He signed up for drama classes, and one of his teachers said something that sounded familiar.
He said, you know, if you really put your mind to this, you could be great. I was lost. I didn't know what I was going to do, and I took that to heart, and I really got into a play, and I practiced and worked at bars and worked at insurance companies while I took classes at night and did plays when I could and just kind of immersed myself with that same vigor that you have as an athlete.
But Tug Coker wasn't finished with basketball, not nearly, because in late 2011, producers started sending out casting calls for a new Broadway play based on the rivalry and friendship between Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. I should say that Tug is white, so when he showed up for his audition, the role of Magic Johnson was out.
You know, Larry Bird's 6'9", I'm 6'5", and I thought they're just going to find some unknown in Minnesota. And he's going to get his big break, and good luck to him. So I performed a couple scenes, and I waited outside for like 15 minutes, and then the casting director came out and gave me a hug. And I've never gotten a hug from a casting director after an audition before or since. So I went from not believing I had a shot to calling my dad and like, I think I just did this. I think I just got a job on Broadway.
Tug did get that job, which led him to meeting two of the most accomplished basketball players of all time.
They waited on the script. They waited on the notes. You know, Magic came to rehearsal. That was incredible. He just sat there and kind of watched. And then slowly he gave a note on like what he thought like Larry would do in that moment. And I did it. And he would start to make that electric smile that you get from Magic Johnson. Next thing you know, he's like just the wattage, you know, of Magic Johnson takes over. And you realize, oh, Magic Johnson's in the room.
And so in early 2012, Tug Coker found himself standing on a Broadway stage, being introduced to the theater the way he might have been introduced at a basketball arena if he'd had the chance to start in college.
Playing Larry Bird, Mr. Tug Coker!
I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. To portray my favorite player of all time, Larry Bird. I mean, I couldn't have imagined that in a million years. He left me a 7-second voicemail that said, hey, Tug, this is Larry Bird calling. I'll try you later. I still have that. That's never going anywhere.
I was in the audience for one of the preview performances of Magic Bird in March of 2012, and other than that awful mustache that might have been just a tad too close to the real thing, I thought Tug did a great job.
Irvin Johnson, 42 minutes, field goals 9 for 16, assists 12, rebounds 11.
I was pretty proud of the way I handled the basketball on the stage. I shot like 10 shots in the show, as you know. I'm left-handed, but I trained myself to play right-handed. My wife and I would go out to the court, and I would shoot 100 free throws a day right-handed, just trying to get that form that Larry had. That's an athletic desire to be great coming back around. But I remember the first night I missed a layup. I was so jacked up.
Okay, so the basketball was hit or miss. One night, a miss flew into the audience and landed in a row of Olympic athletes. But for a while there, Tug's childhood dreams were coming true.
All of the things I wanted as an athlete, I kind of got to achieve as an actor, which is odd. I mean, I was in Sports Illustrated, and they talked about the show on PTI, and all these things that I devoured as a kid, they recognized, but not as an athlete, as a fake athlete.
As a fake athlete, Tug was getting a lot of attention, but the show wasn't doing as well as the producers had hoped. When I showed up for my promised interview with Tug and his co-star, Kevin Daniels, I was told that they were reworking scenes and could no longer be made available. And then Magic Bird was completely shut out of the Tony nominations.
The lead actor nominees that year were James Corden, who won, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Frank Langella, James Earl Jones. I mean, that's just the best of the best. and Tug Coker. Not nominated, but he was, you know, you could have voted for him. So just to be, you know, in that ilk.
Ilk or no ilk, zero Tony nominations weren't enough for the producers of Magic Bird. On the same day the nominations were announced, they decided that the show would close after just 38 performances.
We got like a 2-week notice. I almost broke down on the show because I felt like in some ways, Larry has been so successful in his career with championships and coaching and GMing. And this is one of the things that wasn't a success in people's eyes. And I felt like in some ways I'd let him down.
But don't feel too bad for the folks who worked on Magic Bird.
Starting from Tommy Cale, who directed the show, to the like lighting designer, costume designer, set designer, sound designer, all worked on Hamilton as their next Broadway show. I missed it by one show because the next show is Hamilton.
Tug says he was in shock after the show closed. It's hard to top playing Larry Bird on Broadway.
Part of the struggle of being an actor is you don't have the control. So it's not every day that you get to be on a project that you're so excited about every day to go to work. And that's what you chase. You just get that little taste of something you believe in, and you just want it more and more and more.
So Tug and his good friend Tommy Dewey decided to get together on a project. And since they're both passionate about sports, they decided to make a show about former athletes, football instead of basketball players this time.
I'm not going to knock Tommy. He'll listen to this, but I don't buy him playing basketball. The show, I should say, is called Now We're Talking. And it's about two quarterbacks who used to be on a team for a time together. And they now retire, and they try to figure out the next stages of their life. We just fell in love with this idea of two former athletes getting into broadcasting, having like this buddy comedy of these guys on the road together.
We've said it over and over again tonight. Arm wrestling is a game of leverage. You want to get that belly up nice and tight against the table.
Excellent move by Redshirt. That's what the pros call a thumb climber.
The short-form comedy series is available on Verizon's video streaming app, Go 90. So it's meant to be watched on your phone. And if you think that means the show is small potatoes, consider this. The guy who played Larry Bird on Broadway is now producing a show in conjunction with Uninterrupted, the sports media company founded by LeBron James.
It's just a fun little nexus of like these athletes trying to do entertainment and these actors trying to dabble in the sports world. And we got some great cameos. And it's kind of funny to see how it all comes full circle.
Unlike Larry Bird, LeBron James has not weighed in on character development. While the show was in production, he was a little too busy helping the Cleveland Cavaliers win the city's first championship in 52 years. Now We're Talking isn't Tug Coker's only big co-production this year. He and his wife recently had a baby, and that started Tug looking back and wondering, what if?
He's 4 months old, and I see that miracle, and I'm like, man, I really wish I'd seized that opportunity to play college basketball more, because you just only get one shot, and next thing you know, you're 20 years out of college or whatever. And I realized if I could have stuck with it, I could have maybe played in Europe.
Well, I hate to tell you, but if you had gone and played in Europe, you wouldn't have learned to be an actor and you wouldn't have gotten to play Larry Bird on Broadway.
That's true. That's really true. I don't know. I want my cake and eat it too. I guess I want to. I want it all.
That's the actor Tug Coker speaking with Only a Game's Karen Given. Now We're Talking is available on Verizon Go 90, and you can find a link at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder and from Fernando Lopez and Daniel Dopp at ESPN. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Welcome to our new intern, Jeremy Relosa, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Tug Coker, who describes what happened when his mom ran into that college coach who turned him down.
My mom, who's my biggest protector, saw Pete Yellen a few years later and let him have it. She really told that guy off.
College basketball coach versus mom. No contest. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. And thanks for listening.